So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, everyone, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Today, we are diving into the wild world of NFTs, or non-fungible tokens. You've probably heard a lot about them over the past few weeks, but they seem to be reshaping the way the digital economy is working, especially when it comes to art, and that's going to be a fun conversation. As usual, you can subscribe to the Engadget podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's super helpful, and you can always reach us at podcast@engadget.com. We typically do a live stream on Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern, so you can join us for the live chat and conversation around that. That's always a fun time. Let's move into NFTs, and to help us break all this down, we have a special guest from Engadget, our own in-house financial guru, Dan Cooper. How's it going, Dan?
Hello. It's going very well, and thank you for having me. I like coming on for my sort of annual trot out to come and see you all.
We just bring you out to get your add some class to the show. I feel like that's always good, right?
Pretty much, although I'm very annoyed that there aren't canapes and classical music playing.
Dan, I will ask you first up, because NFTs, non-fungible tokens, this is a topic where when I first started reading about this and seeing the news break about this, I felt like cheaty in The Good Place as they were explaining the Jeremy Baramy thing of just like, this is the one new topic that just absolutely broke me and broke my brain and just made me feel like I am out of place in this civilization. What are NFTs? Can you tell us what is going on with them?
Okay, so you're probably going to get emails from crypto people saying, oh, sure, you're doing it totally wrong, but I'm going to pitch this at people who don't know, like you, Dev, who don't know what an NFT is and probably don't know what a crypto.
I don't know
is.
Anything, Dan, so please explain it to me like I'm a five-year-old.
So an NFT is essentially a way of making something that can't change. The name itself is a non-fungible token. And a nice way of explaining it is basically to explain that a Bitcoin can be chopped up. In the same way that you can split a dollar into change, a Bitcoin can be broken up into smaller chunks and handed around. Because fundamentally, you're not there kind of holding on to the coin, the dollar, the Bitcoin, anything else. It's not like that one coin holds any special meaning for you.
Like, Dan, one quick step back.
Go on.
What is a Bitcoin, by the way? Because everyone's also talking about NFTs and blockchain. Kind of how does it relate? Because I feel like this is one continuous story from the founding of blockchain to where we are now.
So Bitcoin was this grand attempt to create a secure, decentralized form of money. And the idea was that you would create these coins. The system that was built would create these coins called Bitcoins, and then everyone would hook their computer up to run this network. And the idea in the great sort of original founding was that it was a form of money that governments didn't control, and pretty much no one controlled. Everyone just signed up with their computer, and it was a free world for everyone, and there were no banks, there was no exchanges. One Bitcoin in the US was worth the same as one in Argentina. You could move money around without any real cost, and this grand utopian ideal sort of foundered because a lot of people realized that you shouldn't really use Bitcoin as a method of exchange, because the value, as more and more people bought in, it became more and more like a store of value, like gold, rather than dollars and cents. And so Bitcoin, certainly over the last year, I think, a lot of people have been stuck indoors. They've had spare money. Maybe they've got stimulus checks, and they've been trying to do something useful with that money. And so all of a sudden, Bitcoin has gone from a very crazy valuation. It goes up and down. Now it's close to $50,000. I think it's gone past and back through $50,000 per Bitcoin a couple of times in the last few months, which is mad given that it didn't exist 12 years ago.
Well, no, it was 2009, right? Which is when
the fabled
Satoshi Nakamoto basically created this thing. But also the key to Bitcoin is the blockchain, right? And all these pieces of the puzzle kind of get us to NFTs. Explain what the blockchain is, because that to me seems like the key innovation here, because it doesn't matter what you care about. Like, you may never want to have a Bitcoin or buy or sell things with Bitcoin, but I feel like the blockchain is the core technology that is enabling a lot of new things too.
So the blockchain is the thing that a lot of other business people have been interested in, a lot of industries have been interested in, because it's this idea, it's called the open ledger. And essentially it is a long string of data, and every transaction that takes place on the Bitcoin currency is added to this long single public document. Now, think of it like a spreadsheet that everyone who's able to can access and look at. And every transaction, you can see person A sent money to person B on this date. And whilst you may not know who person A and person B are in the real world, you can see where the money is going, what's happening to it. And the idea is, firstly, it's the sort of complexity necessary to make Bitcoin safe and secure, but also it's this idea of making every transaction public. And so if anything goes wrong, people can immediately scroll back through. You know, a couple of months ago, Twitter was hacked and some people ran a Bitcoin scam through Twitter. Loads of people on Reddit and everything else were immediately scanning through the blockchain, looking for where the money was being funneled out of those wallets that people had paid money into. So in that regard, there's a lot of interest for cross-border financial transactions, for asset tracking for businesses, even for, you know, people are saying about using the blockchain for government. The one thing I'll kind of segue into is that NFTs is this idea that you can create a contract, a sort of a binding contract that sits on the blockchain and creates this single piece that then can be analyzed and looked at in public, if you see what I mean, but also can't be messed around with by
anyone. So the blockchain was kind of this idea, too, of basically uniting the best of credit card data, digital transactions, and the freedom and power of cash. How does that get to NFTs? You know, because these are basically digital objects that we're talking about right now. These aren't like, this isn't like trading cards or physical art or something. Now we're talking about digital art. We're talking about tweets. We're talking about a clip from an NBA game or something. How did we get to here, and what exactly are the NFTs? What do those represent?
So The original idea was that you could create contracts as NFTs. And what happened, certainly in the last couple of years, was this idea that you could tie something that was digital, something that was ephemeral, and you could tie it to an NFT and say, well, actually, this is the one version of this digital ephemeral thing that is more real. And we'll probably come on to this, but there's a certain level of a sort of a grand delusion behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm sure we'll get
to. What is reality? What is reality, Dan? What is more real when it's digital and everything is bit for bit the same?
Yes. That is essentially it. Part of it comes down to, you know how a t-shirt company in New York decided that they would just put, they would copy Barbara Kruger and they put a logo on a t-shirt and they said to everyone, this is worth way more than we'll sell it to you. And it became this thing where everyone would queue up. I'm talking about Supreme, but I don't want to annoy the hype beasts. And essentially, through purely just putting something out there and saying, this is valuable, people now, like, Supreme is like half owned by a giant luxury hedge fund or something. It's absolutely crazy the amount of money. NFTs are a bit like that. It's this idea that there can be a JPEG of a piece of digital art and they can be infinitely copied and there's no generation loss or anything else. Like, if I take a picture, if I take a selfie and I put it on Twitter or Instagram, you can copy that 1,000 times with no generation loss. But the one that I attach to an NFT is meant to be more equal than all of the others. All images are equal, But we're going to pretend that the one tied to an NFT is the one that's the original, even though it's not.
Okay. Listen, we're talking a lot about NFTs here too. This is not exactly a new thing. Over the past few years, we have seen art and crypto art become a thing. I think CryptoKitties was the one that kind of got really, not quite mainstream, but certainly got a lot of headlines. And that was like, what, 2017? How did CryptoKitties get us to here? And what is the best analog for that? Is it like trading cards or Pokemon cards or something?
It is definitely Pokemon cards or Beanie Babies, something that has no, I mean, I guess a Beanie Baby does have a small inherent value because you can give them to small children or animals and they can cuddle them if you dare take them out of the packaging, obviously. But with CryptoKitties, the nascent idea at that point was you buy a digital cat and then you buy another digital cat and you breed them. And eventually the digital cat that you breed from the digital cats you've bought will hopefully be more valuable. It'll be more popular, more powerful. And then hopefully you'll be able to sell that digital cat onto someone else who wants to then breed that cat.
You know, Dan, as you're explaining purchase. All this, I just want to jump into a volcano. You know, I just want to like be lifted off of this planet. What are you talking about?
Do you know what? As much as it sounds like I'm anti NFTs, there is a noble goal here. There is the gem of something quite valuable, which is the idea that digital artists who, ever since the birth of the internet, really creative artists have struggled to monetize their work properly.
Sure.
Because, and as the technology's improved, it's become a lot easier to devalue art. So for instance, a CD, you know, a 600 megabyte CD was enough to kind of compress into 3 megabyte MP3 files and then push through LimeWire or Kazaa or Napster or anything else. Now that we've all got, iPhones and broadband, you can do the same thing with a $200 or $300 million movie, and you can get a compressed but still high quality version of that if, you know, you're unscrupulous and you pirate it and everything else. The idea of this is essentially to say, well, yes, you can pirate this piece of art. You can right click and save and keep it for yourself. Mm-hmm. But this is a way that you can pay the creator of this art. And if if your heart's in the right place and you want to buy the new Kings of Leon album instead of listening to it on Spotify or Apple Music or Tidal or anything else, then you can buy the Kings of Leon album and say to your friends, look, I paid $50 for a Kings of Leon album. You can stand in the middle of the freeway and say very proudly, guys, I paid $50 for the new Kings of Leon album.
It makes you the guy. And one of my favorite memes is just like the guy alone at a party that's just like saying, I paid $50 for this Kings of Leon. Everyone else is having fun because they streamed it for free. But he's like, I got this for $50. It's great.
One thing I want to say is that I agree with Ben. We keep saying Ben, Dan, but these are just like three-letter male names that end with N. So I apologize. But the thing I agree with Dan on is like the benefit this has for artists, because I remember one of the things I saw is this TikTok of this artist explaining how she finally made like $3,000+ dollars off of selling her original artwork as an NFT. And like, to Dan's point, like people can keep making copies of these, but what you're really selling here is the certificate that verifies that you have the original, even if the idea of an original is kind of weird on the internet, but like you have the one that the artist deems it the one. So that's, I guess, worth paying money for in this age. And the other thing, though, is when we were planning this episode, we were talking about this, Devendra, is who gets to decide which one's the original authentic one, right? In some cases, an art is easy, right? Because the artist gets to say it. But in cases where there's celebrities involved, where there are brands involved, it gets trickier, doesn't it, Dan?
It does. And it's a very messy, complicated situation. I was speaking to an artist, actually, and because I didn't know this myself. And essentially, what I didn't realize is that whilst the buyer of a painting, you know, like an old-fashioned painting, the buyer of that painting does not get the copyright to that painting in most cases. And so as a consequence, the original artist can, if they so wish, make a replica of that original painting. and sell the replica one as well. And it's the honor system that essentially keeps that from happening, because they know fundamentally it will devalue their own work and ruin their reputation. But essentially, even in the traditional art world, what you're buying is not the first sale doctrine, ownership rights, as in the US, whereby you don't get to profit from the work that you've bought. You can enjoy it and you can sell it on, but you don't get all of the bundle of rights that ownership normally conveys.
I guess it puts a little bit of the power in the buyer, because the buyer decides also who they want to pay. Like if the NBA, for example, and a player both put up NFTs of the same moment in time, let's say Michael Jordan's first slam dunk ever or something. Sports analogies are not my thing. I apologize in advance. But let's say both of them put that up, right? Who are you going to buy an NFT from, the NBA or Michael Jordan? It's kind of up to you. Or is it, do you go to the cheaper offer? I feel like there's a lot of questions.
That's a whole rights thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean. Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing too. Like I've talked to, and now we're getting into the point of like, why should you care about NFTs? Because I do feel like as a lot of this news has kind of hit us, it's easy to just be like, this stuff, like I'm going to just wrap up this story in a bow and throw it away because I have too much going on in my life. I do think like it is worth thinking about when it comes to artist rights, like we're talking about here too. But I've also seen a lot of digital artists explore like how this on the face of it seems like a good thing. But also this is just immediately bringing us into the world of like speculative art markets and stuff too, like things where it's just rich people who just want these new shiny new things to collect and grow value. Like they don't care about the fundamental power of the art or anything. They don't care about the art. They care about the value of the art. And we're just kind of jumping right into that market. Is that a potential concern, Dan? Because it does seem like this is where we are at this point.
That is a big issue, and I think for the big story that I've written that's going up on Engadget.com today.
Thank you. Good plug.
It's very smooth. you know, I've spoken to some investment analysts and people, you know, who work at an investment funds, and they've said that one of the key drivers to this is everyone's hoping to get in at the start because they've missed the Bitcoin bubble. They've missed the Ethereum bubble. They've got money. It's funny when we talk about this because there's so much sort of inequality right now in a lot of countries where people, you know, they're not able to find work because of COVID and, you know, they're living hand to mouth frequently. They're going to, do you have food banks in the US or, you know, like sort of Goodwill places?
Yeah.
And yet you've got a whole group of people who are so desperate to kind of get this big investment that they are plowing money into digital art in the hopes that being the first is likely to net them big. And ironically, that's already happened. There's a digital artist called Beeple who sold a digital painting, a little video clip last, I want to say November, I should have written down the notes, but he sold this little video clip last year. A guy bought it for $66,666.66 because of course they did. And they sold it last month for, I think, $6.6 million.
Okay.
So already you've got throwing money at this in the hopes that within the next 5 or 10 years, they're going to be able to retire on crypto art investment money, really.
Gotta love it. One other thing we have to mention here when we talk about anything crypto and anything related to the blockchain or even digital currency is the environmental impact. And this is wild to me, okay? Because when Bitcoin started, right, people were just the whole power of that platform, right, was that you were basically harnessing computing power to generate, to actually generate Bitcoin. And that was something people could do with their home computers and whatnot. But over the years, as things got more complex and the actual blockchain grew, right, and became harder and harder to render, you can't do that on your computer anymore. You need specialized equipment. You need servers. All that stuff requires electricity. All that stuff requires natural resources. And it seems like we are just seeing some crazy figures here. I saw a post saying real-time figures from the Cambridge Bitcoin Electricity Consumption Index showed that Bitcoin accounted for 0.4% of the world's total electricity consumption and 0.34% of the world's total electricity production, which that sounds like a small thing, right? It's a fraction of a percent, but that is a lot when you think of the scale of the world and the fact that all this stuff is, it's just like fake digital money. Like it is just an entire thing we're creating to add value, create value to a currency, basically. Like it is a thing we're building out of thin air, but in a time when we're in a climate crisis where, you know, we've had multiple warnings that by 2040, if we don't do something to stop the rate of global warming, we're doomed. It seems insane to me that we're burning fossil fuels for fake money.
To contextualize that just a little bit more, sorry, but just to give that even in more understandable terms, according to an NPR report that we read, an artist estimated that generating 6 NFT pieces consume more electricity than their entire physical studio did in 2 years. That's nuts. Mm-hmm. That is crazy.
That's a post from Joni Lemercier, yes, called "The Problem of Crypto Art." So go read that. But it's astounding. It's kind of wild. I think it's one thing if this was a purely just like, hey, we're just making this digital stuff. It's not hurting anybody, right? We're creating this market that's, we're just making a value. Some artists are getting money. It's not hurting anybody, except it's kind of hurting everybody, right?
Do you know, I'm going to give you a long answer and it's going to be very even-handed, sure, for which I apologize. Sure. But I think we need to be very clear about a couple of things. A lot of NFTs aren't running on Bitcoin. They're running on Ethereum, which works a little bit differently.
But also it's still a major power.
It is still a big issue because both the technology or the system that underpins the Bitcoin blockchain and the Ethereum blockchain essentially requires hundreds of computers or thousands or millions of computers all plugged in, solving, essentially brute force solving difficult equations. And then the one that does it fastest essentially gets a cut of the transaction. You mint a coin, you get a physical reward. And so as a consequence, the incentives were at several points great enough that Bitcoin speculators could actually go and like rent a 747, like an old military 747, fly to Taiwan, pick up a 747's worth of graphics cards, and then fly them air freight to Iceland, where the geothermal energy was cheap enough that they were hoping to get a reward. And you say to yourself, that is monstrous. And the stats say now that Bitcoin's energy generation as a whole is more than the country of Argentina, okay? Mm-hmm. Which is bad. And I don't think anyone would say that it's a good thing. Bitcoin's boosters would say, well, actually, the global financial system uses a lot more energy, although the global financial system also does things like run banks and has insurance you know, has customer service. And if you lose your money with a bank, they will at least try and get it back. Whereas with Bitcoin, you're on your own. So it's very different. With Ethereum, the price is pretty much, or the amount of complexity tied in is tied to its value, which is tied to how much power it uses. So it's not as exponential a growth curve as it is with Bitcoin, but it is still a problem. I think the last time I checked, which was this morning, someone was calculating that Ethereum's annual emissions is about 25 terawatt hours a year, which is crazy. That's enough to power it, crazy amounts. And but the thing that CryptoArt's backers will say is that actually CryptoArt only accounts for about 1% of those transactions. And this is I'm being even-handed. They say it's a small amount. And the hope is that Ethereum 2.0, which has been coming now since the start of 2019, the hope is that it will eventually come by the end of this year, but who knows when it will actually arrive. But it will change the way that the blockchain is administered, the system underpinning it, to one that's a lot less energy intensive and one that won't reward the burning of energy so much. The other thing to say
is... I hope so. Yeah.
And then there are other blockchains out there. Flow, all the other ones have escaped me. I think IOTA, but they use a different system that essentially uses a sort of random number generation and other calculations based on how much money you've sort of got in the system. Mm-hmm. But it means mm-hmm. that the overall energy consumption, it's still consuming energy, but it's going to consume a hell of a lot less energy than Bitcoin and Ethereum. So now you have to sort of really think whether investing in crypto art is worth it in the same way that you should when you invest in cryptocurrencies, because mm-hmm. there is an environmental cost, there is a power cost.
Yeah. It's a moral consideration now. It's like, it's almost as if you're like, I'm going to invest in coal-fired power. You know, like, I'm just going to put my money here. And you are essentially doing that because that's the vast majority of where the world's energy comes from. Like, we still rely heavily on fossil fuel energy. It would be one thing if we had like perfect solar energy and renewables, right? And like people were just kind of siphoning power from there. I think that's an even greater argument. But yeah, I'm just, this is the part of this whole story that really just makes me angry. Can we move on? Let's talk about some examples of NFTs that we've been seeing. We talked about some NBA examples. There's NBA Top Shot, which is this service by the NBA that is essentially selling short clips of games, similar to trading cards, except you own that clip. And aren't you special?
Well, you don't own the clip. I mean, this is the thing. You own a copy of the clip with a serial number. Mm-hmm. And there are multiple serial numbers attached to each clip. So you are one of maybe, I think, 100 people or 50 people who own the clip. And well done you. And then you can sell that clip on people. People have already started selling clips that they bought for tens of thousands of dollars, for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's likely to continue. I spoke to, in writing this piece, I spoke to Jack Settleman, who is the founder of Snapback Sports, and he and his friends clubbed together to buy a very famous LeBron James dunk. And they bought serial number 23, which is James's squad number. You can tell I'm not a basketballist. I'm sorry, we don't have basketball in England. And their plan is to sell that for $1 million to LeBron James himself. Because fundamentally, they know that if LeBron James buys it, he can then sell it on to whoever the hell he wants for millions more than he'll buy it. Because the idea is that actually when you have LeBron James selling you an NFT, that's going to be worth a fortune 10 or 15 years down the line, is the hope.
Why would you buy an NFT from someone who bought it from LeBron rather than paying more to buy it directly from LeBron?
Because you missed out, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It should be more valuable if you bought anyhow, but there's more examples. There's been more examples of NFTs, right? Jack Dorsey, famously this week or this past week, I guess. His first tweet ever.
Yeah, I don't know whether he's actually planning to sell it, because the offer, $2.5 million, has been there for a while and he doesn't seem to have accepted it. Maybe he's just doing it for show. But someone has bid $2.5 million to own the NFT for Jack Dorsey's first tweet. Grimes,
I wonder who that is. Yeah.
Grimes and their brother did a crypto art sale. I think they earned $5.8 million mm-hmm. in like 48 hours. And Beeple, who I mentioned before, is doing an auction with Christie's. I think the Christie's auction is running through crazy amounts of money right now. And then the creator of Nyan Cat sold
Nyan Cat, Dan.
It's a British way of pronouncing it. Let him do the British way.
It's not Cyan Cat. It's Nyan Cat.
Nyan Cat. It just doesn't work with my accent.
There we go.
Nyan Cat sold base. And again, this is the crazy thing. It's not like that's the only version of this
right
available on the internet. It's just one that they've made fresh, and they've minted it as an NFT, and they've sold it for $600,000+.
Speaking of the auction you were talking about, Dan, I believe this is breaking as you record this episode of the podcast. The artwork from, I think, Beeple and Christie's sold for $60+ million. I can't remember if you actually mentioned it already, but
it just happened.
It just happened, and it ended right after 10 a.m. Eastern, And it was 60.25 million. So 60 and a quarter million.
Oh, hang on. 69 million. 69,346. We're in the wrong career, friends.
I know. Listen, wow. As we report on things like YouTubers and social media influencers just getting like millions of dollars just for, you know, live blogging and everything, that requires work. That's a whole bunch of stuff. Speculating on digital objects just because, and the only reason you could do that is because you're already rich enough to kind of get into this, is that is, I feel like, the final straw for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It is to a certain extent driven by wealthy people, and certainly people who maybe have cash floating around because maybe they did win big, in the crypto boom over the last year. Maybe they've been holding on to GameStop stock and have ridden that wave, and now they want to put it in something where it'll appreciate far greater value over a longer period of time. And to a certain extent, that's the same with anything that's, you know, a high-end investment product. The rich people are going to get there first and put a tiny amount of their wealth in. And if it's a success, then they're going to reap the rewards 5 or 10 years down the line.
I think my ultimate takeaway from this is that it just feels like, as somebody who's read a lot of dystopian science fiction and, you know, watched a lot of sci-fi movies, this feels like a dumb aspect of the world from Idiocracy that we could not have seen coming, right? This is just absolutely like, hey guys, the world is on fire. What are we going to do? We're going to create more fire to power these, you know, these absolutely insane digital objects and digital currencies. I'm not sure. How do you feel about this, Dan? Like, you've seen this bubbling up. You have a financial background. How do you feel like about things right now?
So I think fundamentally, you could have seen this coming if you thought about the big sort of the halo effect that Bitcoin's rally and then, you know, Dorsey and Musk and, you know, people like that suddenly really throwing the attention into it, because they've taken something that really until last year was still, I would say, something that was on the fringes of acceptable discussion, you know, and now when you've got a company like Tesla, already now a darling of Wall Street, or becoming a darling of Wall Street, and now they're saying, oh yeah, we're sinking billions into Bitcoin, then obviously the interest would spread out to anything crypto. In the same way, a couple of years ago, I forget the name, but there was this company that made like juice, and they changed their name to, was it Lipton, not Lipton iced tea, but something like Lipton iced tea Bitcoin. And suddenly their yeah. share price rocketed because investors were just yeah, let's get in on that. And they eventually got done by the SEC, but they still made a crazy amount of money, you know, because the stock price shot up. So I think things that are Bitcoin adjacent, crypto adjacent, clearly were going to spark a lot of interest. In terms of how depressed it makes me, I think with, like a lot of these things, it's whether the incentives are encouraging people to do socially responsible things. And I don't necessarily think that the incentives that exist now are, but maybe there will be scope for ethical crypto in the future. But I do think that until we get to a system where people aren't encouraged to fly graphics cards, air freight, and do all this and kind of buy power futures because they know that they're going to get a reward for it, that we're going to be locked in this spiral for a way longer.
And Sherlyn, I feel like you've heard some things from your financial friends too about how they're approaching this, probably a little more gleefully.
To obviously prepare for this episode, I was like reaching out to some of my fintech friends, and it was hella confusing. I was just like, I need a basic explainer. And they were like, yeah, don't buy meme. And I was like, huh? and I was like, give me the simplest explainer. My friend was like, well, here's the simple explainer. There's a huge bull market in crypto land. It's created a new generation of wealth. These individuals or with new wealth want to hedge their wealth with diversification. And then they end up buying other stuff. And some of these other stuff, it's NFTs. And there's traditional stuff, like we've mentioned, like the NBA Top Shot stuff, but there's also crazy stuff like meme. So meme is a platform, from my understanding, this is possibly flawed understanding, but Meme is a platform for people to sell stuff as NFTs or sell their NFTs or something, and people pay with Ethereum. And it started with art, but now it's anything, like Dorsey's first tweet. So, I mean, that was a good explainer, I guess, right? But it took me a while to get to, like, what? Like, first 10 minutes of my conversation with my friend was like, what? And then I somehow got introduced to, like, some of the bigger players in NFTs. I'm just like, I was looking for an explainer and someone who could talk about this.
And somehow you found yourself in a boardroom on the 100th floor of a skyscraper somewhere.
Could totally.
How did I get here?
Totally in the inner circle now, which I'm going to sell as an NFT soon. I'm selling the inner circle.
I'm thinking the end of the first episode of Mr. Robot. You've encountered the people who now run the world, and it's all about NFTs, baby. Dan, thank you so much for this explainer help. Anything you kind of want to wrap this up with, or anything you're working on that you want to tell us about?
Do you know what? I will wrap this up by saying one thing. And like everything, this does not constitute financial advice. And I'm certainly not qualified to give it. But what I will say is this. With a lot of these with a lot of these things right now, the hope is that everyone is going to pay a little bit of money and then pass it on, because they don't want to be the ones left holding the money or holding the NFT when the whole thing comes crashing down. So don't forget that a lot of people who are buying and selling now are looking for a sucker. Don't be the sucker.
So let's run away from NFTs and the world of everything crypto, please. And let's talk about things that are a little more tangible. I don't know. How tangible is a $1 billion acquisition? Microsoft's $7.5 billion ZeniMax acquisition is officially finalized. That means they officially own all of the Bethesda studios, including id Software, Arkane, and Bethesda Game Studios, and all of that. That is, you know, it's something we've talked about. It is kind of wild that Microsoft now officially owns the company behind the Elder Scrolls. You know, what else? So many other games. The upcoming Deathloop, which is a PlayStation exclusive. That is going to be a PlayStation exclusive game now being delivered by a company owned by Microsoft. It's all very confusing, but it sounds like more Bethesda games are going to be heading to Game Pass soon. And Microsoft is definitely saying that, new games will be exclusive to Xbox and PC players. So sorry, PlayStation fans. The war of exclusivity is continuing, and I think it's going to get kind of bloody because Bethesda is a huge, huge studio. I'm excited to see where all this goes. I don't know if you have any feelings about these games, Dan.
Do you know what? I'm gonna just say that I think I know that Microsoft are saying that a lot of them are going to be Xbox exclusives, but I have a strong feeling that they're gonna keep supplying PlayStation games as well, purely because from an antitrust perspective, the idea that you buy up like a really big third party supplier of games and you block off your competition, that sounds questionable to me. But also, I think it's a great way for Microsoft to make money and make the money back from this acquisition, because they can burn cash on All Access and give some of these games away for free as part of the subscription model that it's building. But also, if they're selling it to their competition and they have to, you know, people will buy those games because, you know, there's some really exciting titles in that lineup, and certainly Elder Scrolls. You know, has been re-released on every single platform for years. So I think it's good business.
Yeah. I think we could probably see like a year or two of exclusivity from some of those games, because it's kind of what we saw with some games that were exclusive to Sony and PlayStation for a while and eventually ended up on other platforms. That's probably the best way to make this business work out. So that'll be really interesting to see. But hey, Microsoft finally has more original games under its banner, which is something we've been complaining about for a long time. Sherlyn, you want to talk about something new from Instagram, right?
There's a whole bunch of news in the land of social media. We can start with Instagram Lite, I believe was announced this week. It's a 2 megabyte version of the Instagram app.
Two megabytes?
Yeah, we're no stranger to like Lite versions of apps, right? But Instagram Lite
and Facebook, yeah.
I see that Dan wrote the news story about this. Dan, do you want to explain Instagram Lite?
So, broadly speaking, it's just Microsoft's way of compressing Instagram. Oh, sorry.
Facebook.
I'm still drunk from breakfast, clearly. It's still Facebook's way of getting Instagram into countries where the, you know, the data service and the mobile technology isn't as advanced. The real sort of secret sauce to it is that almost all of it is happening on Instagram servers, and then it's being sort of pushed through to the Instagram app on people's phones. But it's still a very surprising piece of engineering that they've managed to get, even if it is a wrapper, just 2 megabytes. And I'm all for app developers really working hard on making mobile apps more and more efficient. So I think it's a good thing.
It sounds familiar to me because Google done a lot of this with like Android Go versions of a lot of the base apps on Android. So this seems to be a trend to like make apps lighter, at least the ones that people use most often and most heavily. But
I mean, there was Facebook Lite, there was Messenger Lite, right? So this is familiar for them.
It's in line with that. Not just Google, Facebook's been doing it too. But other social media, social network news. Let's start with Instagram's parent company, Facebook. Longtime listeners of the podcast may remember that a while ago we talked about how the FTC decided to change its mind about Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp and Instagram, saying it was anti-competitive. So this week, Facebook announced that it's counter-filing, and it wants those charges.
They're like,
it.
How about no?
Yeah.
How about no? We just say no. To what you're saying.
That's the short version of that story, basically. So, yeah, sorry. But I think there's kind of a juicy quote in here, too, where I'm going to try to find the right person who said this, but I think it's just Facebook wrote in its news, in its statement. But it says, "We believe the government should be denied the do-over it seeks," which it's not wrong. Like, I don't think it's basically the government is asking for a do-over, right? Like, that part, I don't feel like it's wrong.
But it also turns out things change and businesses change and Facebook's audience, you know, exploded too since a lot of this happened. Like, I don't know, like, what do you think about this from the antitrust side of things, Sherlyn and Dan, but it doesn't seem like the stuff exists in a vacuum, right? Especially since all these technologies and networks move so quickly, everything grows so quickly now.
Yeah, I mean, we continually ask for more regulation on this podcast of big companies like Facebook, and this is the government maybe catching on, if a little late or slow, to the fact that these are massive, massive companies with huge amounts of power. So it's just tricky, right? Yeah. Like with the timing of this, I don't know if Dan from the UK has a different perspective.
The interesting thing, so I spoke to an antitrust lawyer about this and a couple of other big antitrust cases late last year, and he basically explained that, you know, you don't necessarily need the do-over, because if you can find now that there is a company with a dominant market position and it is abusing that dominance, then there doesn't you don't need to do anything more than prove those two things, and you've got enough of a case for the FTC to start pursuing you. So, however things have changed, I don't think Facebook is very sassy, but I don't necessarily think SaaS is going to provide a strong enough defense, because I think the current administration has really, really put a lot of smart, big antitrust people into sort of leadership positions. And the consequence is there's going to be a lot more of this, and Facebook's going to need a lot stronger defense than just you don't get no do-overs.
Yeah, to be clear, some of the wording here, Facebook's lawyers were saying that the FTC has not alleged facts amounting to a plausible antitrust case. They're just saying there's not enough evidence. There's, you know, these are coming from a fraught environment of relentless criticism of Facebook for matters entirely unrelated to antitrust concerns. That's what Facebook is saying.
Yeah.
Look, we have some time until the FTC and the state attorney generals have to respond to Facebook's motions to dismiss. They have until April to respond. We're going to be following this for a while, it seems like.
Yeah. A couple of things to add here, right? Like this antitrust filing came from when we were under the Trump administration.
Yes, I was going to say.
And now, we're now in a completely different place. But also, we've written about how the Biden administration has brought on people like Tim Wu and Lina Khan, and people who are Wu, who basically created the term net neutrality, right? People who think deeply and have a lot of concerns about how we're handling tech, and Lina Khan in particular is all about breaking up big tech companies because she thinks we are thinking of antitrust and monopolies in completely wrong ways. So this is going to be interesting. I think this is going to be a really interesting year to see how Facebook fights this and other charges are going to be coming from the government.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone else has anything to add to Facebook before I move on to the next social media thing on the list. But
Please.
Let's round out the big three. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Had some news this week too. It's testing full-size image previews finally, because if you've
been following
this, if your picture is not at the right aspect ratio, you post it to Twitter, it'll be cropped in. And in the past, it's been proven or shown that that Twitter's image cropping algorithms are racist, which is wow. So it's testing, like, this is part of, I think, part of the attempt to address some of this, like, racism in its algorithms. But yeah, it's nice to see some work there. There's also, I mean, our producer Ben is also mentioning that this also ruins those tweets where you want to click through to see the full picture for a surprise.
And exactly, yeah.
Sorry, I guess. Listen, like,
you can't make everybody happy. Yeah.
I wish Twitter were able to implement a function where you could choose the preview where it is or what
you know, probably will be able to. But then, yeah, then you lose the ability to just, like, say everybody will see this big surprise image. Yeah.
Or no, choose the part of the picture that will show up first as that preview, and then they can still click through to see the full. Like, it's a functionality,
like a thumbnail. Yeah.
That may just make it a little, like, harder to load the page at some point. I don't know. But here we go. Twitter is also working on things. So, Landa, lots of social media updates this week. Poor Carissa.
Carissa Bell, our hardworking social media reporter. You know, send her some shout outs on your social
She's
media platform
it.
Of choice, because she deserves it.
Yes.
Let's move on to some actual gadgets.
Yeah, lots of them.
Sonos had an actual announcement this year, a company that doesn't really produce many products, right? Like, it's very rare that we get new Sonos hardware, but they announced the Sonos Roam, which is a $169 speaker that is both Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. And it's interesting that this is coming from Sonos, right? Because over the past decade, we've seen things like the Jawbone Jambox make Bluetooth speakers super popular, wireless Bluetooth speakers. Jawbone died, but other companies, pretty much every single company that can make a speaker has made a Bluetooth speaker. I'm a big fan of Logitech's Ultimate Ears Boom lineup and the Mega Boom and all that.
I have a JBL.
So this is... Exactly. Sonos is getting into that market. It's $169, which is almost twice as much as what you'd pay for comparable speakers from other companies. But Sonos has a lot going for it. This will be a speaker that's a part of its network. So if you have Sonos speakers in your home and you want to spread your sound all throughout your house, this speaker can accept that. It can move between Wi-Fi and Bluetooth seamlessly. It can pair with another speaker for stereo sound. I believe you can even, like, tap it to a Sonos speaker, like, bring it right. No, you can hold the play button to kind of bring over what you're listening to from this speaker to your Sonos, to your other Sonos speakers. There's a lot going on here. I kind of want to play with this, but I've also been tempted to get the Sonos Move, which is the $399 one that is kind of a bigger speaker that is both good in your home and then you can lug it out to your backyard or something.
So this is like a smaller, more portable version of the Move, maybe?
Sort of. I feel like maybe the way you think of it is, like, the Move is a speaker that is sounds good, is really meant to be at home, but you could take it around and go, you know, take it to a picnic or something. This is a speaker that is more meant to be on the go, but you could always bring it home and listen to it with the other stuff too. So it's kind of like the inverse relationship.
Because Move and Roam are synonyms, but almost synonyms.
Yep. But I think they're kind of getting into the limitations of their naming scheme right now. But yeah, I think it's cool. I may just get one of these to play with, but I'm also tempted by the Sonos Move. So I don't know. Do you guys have feelings about these speakers or any of these things? It's good to have wireless speakers. They're super useful.
I'll just quickly jump in and say that I think Sonos is known for its audio quality, and I think that's what people are excited by, to get maybe hopefully similar quality in such a small package. But I mean, Dan, if you have any thoughts.
Put it this way, I think this is probably $110 too expensive. because frankly, if I'm out at a picnic, I am not taking a $170 Sonos speaker out with me to a picnic. I'm going to take the Anker, like a $45 Anker that is loud enough,
the cheapest one,
has
possible.
Battery yeah. life, and if someone steals yeah. it or it gets smashed up, I'm not going to be very sad about that. There's no way I'm buying
you are a wise man. Sonos. Yeah,
there's no way. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
A portable Sonos. Yeah, this market has driven basically to nothing so quickly. So that's why Bluetooth speakers have gotten so cheap. And I think why it took so long for Sonos to kind of figure out a way to get in here. But it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. Yeah.
Anyhow, lots of other hardware news. I think that like the Core and Gadget audience will be familiar with what I'm about to tell you all. But this has been, you know, hardware week, right? Sure. First, we had the Asus ROG or ROG. Phone 5.
ROG
Phone 5.
Republic
which
of Gamers
is a gaming,
phone. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a mobile gaming device. It's a gaming phone. It uses the Snapdragon 888, which is Qualcomm's most high-end chipset and not the other high-end chipset that they announced a little bit later in the year. Anyway, this is the 5, not the 4. The last phone was the ROG Phone 3, but they skip 4 because, you know, in Chinese, 4 sounds like death. Anyhow, ROG Phone 5 and ROG Phone 5 Ultimate, 6.78-inch phones with AMOLED displays, high refresh rates, same 144Hz as before. But basically, the improvements mm-hmm. here are not only is the screen about 23% brighter, there's also like a quad DAC for better audio, improved air triggers, everything that I guess a mobile gamer is looking for, perhaps.
It also looks a lot less ugly than the last few ROG phones. So this is, you know, this is pretty cool. My question for you guys, by the way, do you think there will be an iPhone 13? I feel like we're gonna lose that number entirely, right?
They're gonna switch to like
it's
a
gotta letter. Be something else.
They're gonna be like yeah. iPhone forward. That's I put money. It will be iPhone forward and iPhone 5T and something. I don't know.
I'm not gonna let you name any products, really.
They should hire whoever names LG products to name their devices.
Oh God!
The iPhone
the person
wingy.
Whoever names the. I've made fun of this before on our Slack, but whoever names Acer products, try looking up an Acer monitor because it's literally just a string of consonants that don't make any sense. It's like the 5GTWRF.
NXBT107P or something. Yeah, it's great.
Ugh. Anyway, well, hey, shout out. What do you think the next iPhone is going to be called? Because yeah. I would bet. I would put money. It's never going to be iPhone 13.
I'm going to go for 12S.
What else is coming on?
12S. Yeah. I think that's the 12S. Right one. And then followed by...
Weren't the rumors... The rumors were that this would be the full remaster, like the big redesign, because we got 5G this year, right?
And yeah.
They didn't really change much. But yeah, what else is going on, Trillin?
Well, we're talking about iPhone 12S. We're looking at the competitor to Apple, which is Samsung, which announced this week that next week there will be an Unpacked event. Yet another one, because we haven't had enough Samsung events this year. It is called the Awesome Unpacked, which is coincidentally the title of my autobiography in progress. It's going to be on March 17th. And let me actually get that date right. I'm pretty sure. But March 17th. And people are suspecting that it will be about, who knows? I had someone on my Twitter. I know. But someone on my Twitter asked, is this for a note or is this for whatever? And there's some guesses going around. I will say, though, you all should just come to Engadget.com for our live stream because me and Chris Velasco will be watching it with you guys. We'll have a pre-show, a post-show, so mark your calendars. But yeah, you know, Samsung event coming up, aka more phones, which, you know, we always say that Samsung doesn't more make phones. Enough phones, don't we?
yeah, this, we need more Samsung choices. And something's happening with OnePlus too, right?
Yes, OnePlus is also hosting an event. The Samsung event, by the way, is March 17th at 10 a.m. Eastern, so you should come to the Engadget YouTube channel around 9:30 a.m. Eastern. So the other thing is OnePlus has announced that it is going to be showing off the OnePlus 9. That's where we are at now, OnePlus 9 and 9 Pro. I was like, is it 5? No, it's 9.
It's just a 10. Oy, oy. It's just 1 plus 9.
1 plus 9 equals 10. There we go. 9 and 9 Pro. Yeah. The big selling point or the big attention grabber here is that OnePlus has been teasing its collaboration with Hasselblad for a while now, which harkens back to the days when I think it was Huawei that was working with Leica or Leica make cameras on their phones better. And, you know, that's been always one of the complaints against the OnePlus flagships is that their cameras just cannot compare to iPhones and Pixels and even Galaxies. So this might be what it needs, because Huawei's cameras did get a bit better after they teamed up with Leica. So we'll see. But I don't know, Dan, I know you covered Huawei for a bit for us too. Are you excited for the OnePlus with Hasselblad collaboration?
Oh, tremendously. I will be I will be unable to sleep waiting for this handset to come out.
OnePlus has a rabid fan base, and I'm not surprised slash surprised you're part of that. But OnePlus has a lot of fans who will be very, very stoked to see this. But yeah, hardware season. Next episode of the podcast is going to be very interesting. And just FYI, OnePlus's event is going to be on March 23rd. So stick around for that.
One thing I want to say to you, Sherlyn, is happy birthday. There was a major birthday this week for a platform that I don't really love, but hey,
10 years updates old. From Google Land, aka Sherlyn's time to speak to prove that she's an Android / Google girl. Chrome OS celebrated its 10th birthday this week. It was on Tuesday, and you know, happily announced a bunch of updates, which almost amount to a redesign to the platform. So Chrome OS is getting, oh boy, a new phone hub. So it's like a little dashboard at the bottom right of your screen that shows you your phone indicators, like Wi-Fi, cellular connection, battery life, whatever. And you can see your recent Chrome tabs from your phone on the Chromebook too, which I thought was kind of nice. You can also ping your phone from your Chromebook to find it if you've misplaced it. There's some other features like nearby share. You know what? I wrote it on Monday. I can't remember anymore. All of them. But there's a lot.
That's basically it. Lots of new stuff came for Chrome OS. I am shocked that it has been 10 years since we've had these devices. And I think it's been a series of ups and downs. I remember when these were announced, I was like, oh, yeah, cheap computers, right? Give me more cheap computers that are basically web browsers, because that's basically all we're doing. Since then, Chrome OS devices have become really big in schools because they've been cheap. But also, companies keep pushing premium Chrome OS devices, and that is the thing that just makes
me remember the Pixelbook?
Physically angry. I do remember the Pixelbook. I actually have one back here somewhere. But yeah, premium does not work for Chrome OS.
I will say, like, if you want all the updates that they're announcing, the article is live on Engadget. But I was reminded of one feature that actually got me quite excited. It's called Tote. It's this little place that you have easy access to from the launcher, and you can store all your like pertinent files in there that you maybe regularly look at or stuff like that. It will also store the last 5 things that were saved in your clipboard. So screenshots, for example, or whatever you've copied. I think that's cool. For me, I'm always looking at like embargo docs that I open and then close. And then I'm like, shit, I need to look at that press release again or that spec sheet again when I'm doing a review. Yeah. So I find Tote like a useful thing that I have yet to see on other operating systems. But otherwise, a lot of these updates feel like catching up to Windows to Mac OS, like the virtual desktops and stuff like that. So yeah, Chrome OS is growing up. It's a teenager. It's starting to be a teenager. So it's about to get...
Or a preteen. It's going to be a preteen soon. And
we know those are the best years.
A couple years until all that does is talk back to us and roll its eyes. I am not looking forward to that.
Sassy Chrome.
Let's move on to what we've been working on. Just want to do a quick shout out. I am writing up a quick guide of accessories that you will probably want to get for your OLED TV. So a lot of cool suggestions there. I think bias lighting is pretty cool. You know, sound bars and all the usual stuff. But, you know, let me know specifically too, at me on Twitter or wherever. Shoot us a note at podcastengadget.com if you have any other OLED tips, because I could probably still fit some things in there. Sherlyn, what are you working on?
Lots of stuff. I'm going to just try to focus. In addition to secret meetings that I can't tell y'all about, but y'all can guess probably. And one of them I'm actually pretty excited about, and you'll hear about it soon.
Oh, boy.
And interviews on this topic that I'm researching right now in South by Southwest preparation. I've already shouted out the Samsung event and the OnePlus event. Those are the things that are going to be taking up some of my time from this week until the end of my life. March.
Until March. Over.
But, yeah. You know. Being dramatic for effect.
You know.
Yes.
Whenever all the digital currencies use up all of our fossil fuels, that's how long we have. Dan, anything else you're working on that you want to shout out?
It's top secret. I can't tell you, but I'm very excited about it. Mm. But I don't think anyone else will be, but I'm excited.
Very
that's
cool.
The most important thing.
So it must be about the Hyperloop, Dan's favorite gadget, his most beloved gadget. Yeah. Money, yeah, I would bet money it's about Hyperloop, but we'll see. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. I want to shout out a series I've been catching up on called Search Party. It originally started airing on TBS, but it's actually all now on HBO Max. It is a weird show, and I kind of dig it. It is sort of like, it is like a comedy about hipsters in New York, except they get into like searching for a missing girl, and then it sort of turns into like a murder mystery type thing too. I'll be honest, I'm really just watching this because I miss the hell out of New York, and it is really fun to like dive into shows where people were back walking around the streets and going to restaurants and doing cool things. But has a great cast. I love Alia Shawkat. I think it is so unique and so funny. It's also like co-created by Michael Showalter, so it has like some of the funny bits of his like improv comedy too. Check out Search Party. It's on HBO Max. I kind of love the fact that a lot of these shows that were on obscure networks or just not super popular networks are now in a single place for people to binge, and it's well worth checking out. Shirlyn, I feel like you have something to talk about that Dan can probably relate to.
I just want to say that I've heard a lot about Search Party. I've never watched it, but maybe because I should.
It's really
I
good.
Should maybe pay attention to Devendra's recommendations every now and then, because I did this last week. I finally, and I've always been meaning to, but I finally got around to watching Ted Lasso, and people who follow me on Twitter
know that I have
fallen into a deep, deep, dark hole of Ted Lasso and biscuits and football songs, which I've always hated. I've always hated those football player songs because they're annoying as hell, but now I find myself singing Jamie Tartt to the tune of Baby Shark.
Oh, boy.
But yes, Ted Lasso has been a beacon of joy. It's won a whole bunch of awards this awards season. Golden Globes, Critics' Choice.
Well-deserved.
Very well-deserved. Such a hopeful, beautiful show, like Devendra said. But since he's already recommended it on the show, and as much as I'd like to go on and maybe just keep talking to Dan and our other UK teammates about this show, we will take that offline and spare you from that on this podcast.
I will say,
by
the way, it is a show that's, the thing about a good comedy show is that the jokes and everything is just so dense. Yeah. And this is a show that really rewards repeat viewing too. So even though it's like, it's not a very long show. It's what, 10 episodes?
10 episodes.
Yeah. Like you'll go back and rewatch and you will find jokes that you missed.
First, I'm super deep in the Ted Lasso hole. So I've been on the subreddit already, just finished all of the subreddit posts. But I also was talking to Aaron Soporis, our executive editor. And he was telling me he lives, I believe, is either from or lives in Croydon. Croydon's team is Crystal Palace. The team in the show is AFC Richmond. AFC Richmond uses a different stadium than the one they're actually using in the show, which I wasn't aware of until Aaron pointed it out to me. Now, if you're here for hard facts like this, watch the spinoff podcast called Shirlyn, Aaron, Dan, and Matt Talk Ted Lasso with Tech
involved. Talk to Lasso. Well, speaking of Ted Lasso podcast, I did I guested on a Ted Lasso podcast called LassoCast, which I think right now is probably going to be really hard to SEO for. Like, it's, you're going to always end up with just IMDb listings. Yeah. But I talked about the finale of the show with them for like 2 hours. So that was fun. I love the show. Check it out. What else?
Yeah. Okay. So I decided to go. I'm trying to keep it like manageable. Uh-huh. So I'm going to blaze through some of these. I decided to make it a Brit themed set of recommendations this week.
Oh no.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's a lot coming. Well, after I saw Ted Lasso, I was like, I want something still heartwarming and stuff. So I wanted to see another Jason Sudeikis thing. I made the mistake of watching Colossal on Hulu.
Yeah, great
Anne
movie.
Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis, but not Jason Sudeikis is not heartwarming, not nice in it whatsoever.
That's actually the movie that I think does a great job of really getting to the heart of what I used to think of Jason Sudeikis, of just like this kind of smarmy asshole. Yeah. But Colossal is very good. It's on Hulu right
good.
Now.
Watch it if you want like a good strange monster flick, but that it's really just more drama than it is science fiction and monster and more about.
It's a really interesting twist on the typical kaiju formula in a way that makes it very and
fresh.
It is directed by somebody who I love, Nacho Vigalondo. Mm. All of his movies are fantastic. Yes. So
it's on Hulu, but I was like, okay, never mind. And then I wanted to keep watching more British people talk at me, so I actually ended up and this is not by any means something people don't know about. Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which I freaking have loved for years and years, and it's won all kinds of awards, but I have been catching up on, U.S. history and U.S. issues because I skipped the news all of last year, and so now I'm catching up on news from last year via John Oliver. He does a really good job of explaining a lot of like difficult concepts, and I think watching his show every week instead of trying to do the catching up and research yourself could be an easy way for you to get informed. And the writing's dynamite.
It's good. It's a good show.
Yeah, it's a really good show. I love this segment that they do called And Now, where they pull the weirdest moments from internet and TV and they just compile it, and it's great.
Yeah.
Finally, my last British thing recommendation. I wanted to do like a proper recommendation that people might not know. People on this podcast might have heard me talk about a little show I love with my whole life called Torchwood. Devendra, we've talked about Torchwood.
We have talked about
Dan,
Torchwood.
Dan, yeah. I think even we have talked about Torchwood.
We've talked. Well, I was at Yanto's shrine and I sent you a picture and it went to the wrong phone. And Yanto. Like 6 months later, you were like, why are you sending me this?
That definitely was a surprise, but I will receive your Yanto pictures. Yeah. Anytime. Torchwood is a...
Why are you watching Torchwood? It's done, Trillin.
This is just a recommendation for people who might not have heard of it before because it's still somewhat obscure every now and then. I don't know. It's a more adult Doctor Who. Have we actually talked about this? We might have. More adult Doctor
Who. We have talked about this. So, by the way, my favorite Torchwood-esque memory is one of my early Comic-Cons, so it was probably like 2009, 2010, was walking, basically confronted John Barrowman. As he was stepping out of an elevator.
I think he told me this.
It looks like he just got off his 12-hour flight from the UK. So he's like, what floor is this? Huh? I'm like, it's okay, buddy. Like, just get back in there. And I directed him to the right spot. But that is the joy of Comic-Con. You just run into these people.
Definitely. So Torchwood is a really great science fiction series. It's short. It's tight. Watch just the first three seasons. Maybe up till Children of Heaven.
Just the first three.
You're good. Everything else that happened after, I don't know if it's necessarily canon. I don't know. But science fiction TV, Torchwood is one of those. One of the good ones. Dan.
Anything you want to shout out, Dan? Yeah.
Yes. Do you know what? I really want to talk about Ted Lasso because I haven't had... I want to say this. I'm sorry. So I did the preview of Ted Lasso. I basically fought Devendra. I was like, no, I want to do the preview. And Apple sent over, this is a little bit inside baseball, but Apple sent over the first three episodes for me to watch. And I remember watching it thinking, okay, the first episode, the end of the first episode, I'm like, oh, okay, so they've taken this two-dimensional character and they've made him sad for reasons. And and I thought it was amusing. But it's not until you get to the end of that third episode and then it kind of the camera sort of pans out and you sort of spend time with the other characters and things start to warm up. And then the day before my review went up, and in fact it was written and ready, they then put out the next three episodes. And then I watched them.
Okay.
But like the deal was that you review the first three. And then I watched the next three and I realized that I'd actually done the show quite dirty because I said it was good.
I remember that as we were talking about it. Yeah.
And I remember saying, you know what? It's my expectations going in were so low. And the fact that it doesn't, it doesn't whiff and it, you know, it's fine. And in fact, it's not until you get to like the fourth episode and then you realize that there are layers upon layers upon layers. And actually the show is way better than I think it has any right to be, given that it's like, you know, a character from, from an advert that's been turned into a sitcom.
It is kind of I think we occasionally run into these things called like miracle shows, right? Like just the elements coming together, like this should not work. But I also think like you look at the show's co-created by Bill Lawrence, a guy I love. He did Scrubs. He did Cougar Town.
I love Cougar Town.
He's always done a great job of balancing comedy and even like slapstick stuff with real drama, real emotion. And this show is just like the distilled version of what he's always done. So,
point out, like to echo kind of what Dan said, but maybe like more with more from the show stuff, I guess, not to spoil it for anyone, but there are moments in the show where like there are, it builds up to what seems like a common trope where like either this little seed of drama is sowed and you expect it to bloom one way where like maybe a little piece of potential tension between two characters is planted. So the coach character and like their star player character, there's a hint of potential drama brewing. But the show sidesteps that typical plot altogether and just buries it for a little bit and then resurfaces it in like three episodes later in a totally different way where it actually gives you room for character growth and it makes you just, there's no moment, there's so many moments during the show where I'm like, oh no, this is going to come back and bite them in the butt. But actually it doesn't in the way that I expected. It comes back in a very rewarding and like, oh, this character has grown so much kind of way. And I freaking love that.
For sure, for sure. It is a rare show where everybody's like emotionally mature in a way too. Like that's kind of how everything happens.
Not everyone, but like most people. They're open to learning.
But it handles most situations in a mature way. I don't think there's like, even the people you kind of hate at the beginning get nuanced and interesting. I think there's only one like villain who is, who's a bad guy, but also he's played by Anthony Stewart Head. And just like in pure like smarmy jerk face mode, who for some reason looks even better than he did in Buffy. So I love that guy. He's really fun to watch.
And he's apparently a very nice person.
That's nice.
I just want to say, I don't know whether this has just hit HBO Max or whether it was sort of bubbling under for a while, but I saw someone pointed out that The Thick of It is on HBO Max.
Oh no, The Thick of It was on Hulu before this. No.
Yes.
Okay, so
I can't deal with Thick of It.
Oh my god, The Thick of It is Veep, but for smart people, because I hate Veep. I've really not been able to get on with Veep. But I love The Thick of It so much. It's such a glorious, such a dense with jokes, dense with language. It is such a funny show, but also it's a show that I don't really know how to explain it, because it's a show that is a sitcom.
It's the inner workings of British politics.
But the people are so bad. Everyone is such a dipshit character on there. My main issue with Thick of It is mostly the use of shaky cam. I get nauseated very easily, and Thick of It has a lot of them.
That's the style.
And that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online
at Devendra on Twitter, and I podcast about movies and TV at /filmcast@filmcast.com.
And you can find Dan online at
Daniel W. Cooper on both Twitter and Instagram.
If you want to send me awesome British things and food, I am at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
You can tell I'm not a basketballist. I'm sorry, we don't have basketball in England.